From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today we'll hear remembrances of Congressman John Dingell.
We hunted together, we talked together, we sat together. Over the years, he became a surrogate father to me.
Plus, we'll hear what Dingell thought of his major accomplishments. Also, the governor and the legislature are fighting over panels that could challenge environmental rules.
But it puts a number of people in the regulated industries on the committee to oversee them.
What do our political commentators expect from the governor's State of the State address next week?
I think that she's going to show a shift in tone toward climate change, cleaning up our Great Lakes and our communities.
Plus a cheers cocktail using winter fruit.
One of the few things that I appreciate about winter is that we get this great influx of really interesting citrus fruit.
All that plus sewers and taxes. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The United States' longest-serving member of Congress has died. Michigan's John Dingell passed away yesterday at age 92. We'll talk with a couple of people who knew Congressman Dingell, but before we do that, we wanted to look back at part of an interview we did with him on Stateside on his 90th birthday back in 2016. We asked how he was doing and whether he was keeping an eye on politics since retiring. He was not thrilled with the state of things.
Politics has gotten to be a sort of dirty business where people don't have the trust and don't have the belief in the system and don't have the love of the country that they need to have if we are to be a strong and a free nation.
Republican Congressman Fred Upton worked with John Dingell in the House of Representatives from 1987 through Dingell's retirement. Fred Upton joins us now. We've heard and read a number of remembrances of Congressman Dingell today. What stands out about him in your mind?
Well, so many things. We're the two deans of our respective delegations in the state. Of course, he was the dean of the House. But I knew him first as a staffer, and then as a member of Congress, and then he was my chairman, and then I was his chairman. Our relationship never changed. He treated people, his constituents, his staff, always terrific, his colleagues, but his love for the country, the institution, were always at the top of the ladder. And you know, I got to say, I had a chance to talk to him at length earlier this week on Wednesday morning, and he was the same old John. Fred, how's your wife? How's your daughter? I know she's married, living up in Boston. How is she doing? How's your son? And he cared about people as it was they were his own. One of his staff earlier this week said, you know, he was always correcting me because I would say I work for John Dingell, and he'd say, no, you work with John Dingell. He did so much for our state, so much for our country. The auto rescue plan, I can remember he called me early one day during the August recess. I mean, it was really early. And he goes, Fred, we got to work on this together. We got to save the industry. And you know what? We did it on a bipartisan basis. And Michigan would not be in the state of manufacturing that we're in if we hadn't have done that. So lots of accomplishments.
That word you used, bipartisan, I mean, in recent years, all we hear about is the partisan divide and how very few members of Congress socialize with people of the other party. You're a Republican. He was a Democrat. How did that work out between you two?
Well, we were always close. His office was across the hall from mine for years. You know, I know his wife real well. They know my wife real well. They know our kids. We did socialize together. But we respected each other, and yes, we worked together. And when you look at our committee, and the Energy and Commerce Committee is arguably considered the top committee in the Congress, so more jurisdiction than the world. And always our committee has been bipartisan. The members on our committee are able men and women, sharpies, I would say. But at the end of the day, whether it's telecommunications, whether it's health care, whether it's the environment, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's energy, all of those have been done pretty much on a bipartisan basis. And when our committee moves a bill, gets ready for the House floor, it happens.
Let me ask you this. John Dingell could be a little gruff, and I get the idea he did not suffer fools gladly, but he also had this dry wit. How did that humor play out between you two?
Oh, he had a great wit. And you know what? I'm a little bit of a trash talker, too, so I can give it right back to him. And we did with a smile on his face. But as I said, you know, it's also a lot more fun to be with you than against you. But when we were against each other, it was never personal. It was always based on the facts. And we were always friends at the beginning as well as at the end.
John Dingell was in Congress for 59 years, longer than anyone else, and despite the documented issues in Michigan, voters still seem to favor term limits for Congress. How does John Dingell's nearly six decades of holding office play into this whole debate about the idea of term limits?
Well, you know, I remember we had this debate. I actually looked it up, knowing that this fateful day was coming here for the last week or so. But I remember a speech that one of the Republican icons gave on the House floor. His name was Henry Hyde. And Henry took on the issue, I think it was on term limits. But I remember him standing in the well of the House, looking at one of my colleagues and raising just his little finger and pointing at that colleague and saying, you know what? John Dingell has more intelligence in his little finger in terms of how this institution ought to run than a lot of you have. People elect people based on what they do, and we compete for it every 2 years, and John Dingell could have been elected for another 100 years if he could have lived that long.
I want to ask you, what's the best way to honor your colleague, John Dingell, in a way that's meaningful?
Well, reflect on his life. People think about the struggles that we have. I mean, we have a divided government. You know, Washington doesn't always work, that's for sure. I mean, you look at some of the giants that we've lost. George Bush, 41, who, by the way, Dingell just had a book that he did, and President Bush, H.W. Bush, actually wrote a tribute on it. John McCain, same thing. We've lost some real giants in the last number of months. And as we try to chart a course to get out of this gridlock that we've had, we need to think about the people that actually tried to fight that and where we want to go back to. So we want his legacy to live, and it's a reminder to us all of things that we can accomplish when we work together.
Fred Upton represents Michigan's 6th Congressional District. We've been talking about John Dingell. Congressman Upton, thanks very much for taking a moment to talk about John Dingell with us.
You bet. He was the best.
Joining us now is a friend of John Dingell's, Detroit News columnist and editor of the paper's editorial page, Nolan Finley. Nolan, I think it might be surprising to some that a conservative columnist was close to a Democratic member of Congress. How did that come about?
Well, I mean, we hit it off almost immediately. John and I have been fast friends for almost 30 years, and you know, it never seemed that strange to us. We talked a lot about politics, obviously. Both of us very passionate about politics. And never once can I recall us having an angry conversation about politics or leaving each other with hard feelings. We listened to each other. We respected, appreciated each other's viewpoints. You know, but it was never about politics with us. It was never about business. We were friends. We hunted together. We talked together. We sat together. Over the years, he became a surrogate father to me. We were that close, and you know, it never was about politics.
A friend of mine who worked with Congressman Dingell talked about what an avid hunter and conservationist he was. You guys hunted together.
Yes, he taught me to shoot a shotgun properly, and he was always proud of that. He'd tell everybody when we met somebody, he'd say, I taught him how to shoot a shotgun. And he was an excellent shot. He was, an excellent hunter. And because John loved the outdoors, loved hunting, loved fishing so much, America's got a lot cleaner water and a lot cleaner air and a lot more wildlife because he dedicated himself in Congress to conservation. And it was precisely because he was a hunter and a fisherman and an outdoorsman that he wanted to protect our environment, and he did.
He was responsible for negotiating acquisition of some land, I believe, from Chrysler for the Detroit River International Wildlife Refuge, part of its area called—
A lot more land than that. I mean, he was the driving force behind putting that entire wildlife preserve together. And when I was with him Wednesday night talking with him you know, in his home here, he said, you know, he was very concerned about the wildlife preserve and that it go forward and continue to progress. And he saw that as his legacy, and it was the most important thing to him. So that was very much on his mind, even in his final hours.
John Dingell mastered Twitter better than a lot of people 60 years his junior. Why do you think that social? Yeah, why did you think that social media platform worked so well for him and his sense of humor?
Well, because he did have such a sharp wit, razor wit, but also because John Dingell was, after leaving Congress, he was a bit of at a loss, you know, because his body was failing him. He wasn't able to get out and do the things he wanted to do. And yet his mind was still sharp. He felt he still had a lot to contribute to the political discourse. And Twitter gave him a way to do that. It gave him an outlet, and he just loved it. And he loved the response. You know, he had something like 300,000 followers. He loved the fact that people enjoyed his tweets so much.
What are you going to miss most about your friend?
His good counsel. I mean, his love, his friendship. I never came in and saw John without the first thing he said was, "Hello, my dear friend, tell me about you." He was intensely interested in other people. It was never him first. And, you know, just his caring. I mean, it's what you miss about the people you love.
Nolan Finley, columnist for the Detroit News and a friend of Congressman John Dingell, the longest-serving member of Congress ever, who passed away yesterday. Nolan, thanks very much, and our condolences.
Thank you, Lester. Appreciate it.
You know, back in 2016, I asked Congressman Dingell about his use of Twitter and humor. Here's what he told us.
We have two great humorists in this country, Mark Twain, if you'll remember, and Will Rogers. People used to ask them how they did it. They'd say, well, we just tell them the truth, and they think it's funny. And that's exactly what they did. That's exactly how people reacted. And the end result was that people listened to them and thought, wow, this guy talks sense. We just tell them the truth, and they were not getting much of that elsewhere.
John Dingell, 59 years in Congress. He died yesterday at the age of 92. Hey, we've got more for you after this break. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You think the roads are bad in Michigan? The state's stormwater systems are just as bad. The American Society of Civil Engineers puts out a report card for Michigan's infrastructure, and in 2018, the roads and the stormwater systems both got a D-. But stormwater is kind of out of sight, out of mind. We don't think about it until the streets are flooded or the sewer backs up into your basement. Here to talk a little bit about Michigan's ailing stormwater system is Greg Kozvinski with OHM Advisors. So why did Michigan get that D- grade?
I was actually part of the group that gave that grade. For multiple reasons. Number one, we built a lot. We developed a lot after World War II. So our cities grew quickly. During that period of time, we kind of neglected the older parts of town. So all those pipes and manholes are starting to age, and many of them are 70, 80 years old, and they've never really been touched. And the other side of it is that Michigan cities, the vast majority of them anyway, don't have a funding source for stormwater. So they really can't get to it.
Now, why did you talk about that? Because at least one city does, and it's getting a lot of complaints. We'll talk about that in a little bit. We saw this huge sewer pipe collapse in Macomb County. It cost millions of dollars to fix just that portion of it. Is that Michigan's stormwater management future?
I think for a lot of our utilities, that is the future. You know, sinkholes is just one thing. When you get to water systems, it's people getting sick, like Flint. And with stormwater, it's not just sinkholes, but it's flooding. It's people's basements getting backed up. It's streams going out of their banks and damaging property all over the place.
Let's do a little history about this, because communities used to get a lot of federal money for projects like this. That money's kind of dried up. Why?
So after the Clean Water Act, which was passed in 1972, there were billions of dollars poured into federal grants, and those were grants. So those were monies given to communities to build sewer systems, treatment plants, water systems. That money started drying up in the early to mid-1980s, and the EPA changed its focus on loans instead of grants.
Right, it's a revolving loan fund, if I remember right.
Exactly. Yeah. So where communities used to be able to rely on money coming down or raining down from the federal government, now the federal government is there to say, we'll give you money, but we'll give you a low-interest loan, but you're going to pay us back. And that's harder to swallow.
There is a lot of old infrastructure, as you mentioned. I think of Detroit, and cities like Detroit are now taxing homes and businesses on a square footage of their roof as a way to raise funds for stormwater runoff. Businesses are screaming about how high those taxes are. Is that what other cities are going to be forced to do as we start to deal with these aging stormwater management systems?
So what the city of Detroit is doing is actually – and this is an important statement. It's not a tax. It's a fee. and the key difference between a tax and a fee is for using – you're paying somebody for a demand that you place in the system, right? So in Detroit, if you have a large property with parking lots and rooftop, you place a demand on their system. So the city of Detroit has to send that runoff to their treatment plant because they have a combined sewer system. And Ann Arbor has a stormwater utility fee. And they've had one for probably over 25 years now. And that fee, again, it's a fee, not a tax, is based on the same, impervious coverage on a property. And the city's done quite well with it. They've been able to do a lot with that revenue.
You mentioned combined sewer system. I think those systems are a bit of a mystery for most of us. Some cities have separate stormwater and sewer systems. In fact, the federal government recommended that decades ago, and few cities have taken on that expense. Other cities have these combined stormwater sewer systems. So why is there that difference?
In the early 20th century, as cities really started to develop, it was cheaper for communities to build one set of pipes. So the pipes that were built were essentially, before cities were built up, they were just ditches. And so everything went into the ditch, right? Stormwater, bathroom drainage, everything. And then eventually they started to fill those in and put them in pipes just to get it out of the way, out of sight, out of mind. Those eventually became your combined sewer systems. And what happened is communities, it was too difficult and expensive to replace and separate those systems. So most of the cities that have combined sewers are larger, older cities. Some of the smaller, newer cities were able to separate the systems because things weren't so big and complex. So Detroit is a big old system. New York is a big old system. So is Chicago. They're all combined sewers.
So the problems with those combined sewers are when there's a heavy rainfall and there's a sewer overflow, it goes out into Lake Michigan or Lake Huron or Lake Erie. So we've been seeing in recent years a lot more of these sewer overflows. Why is that happening?
Certainly there are more frequent rainfalls, intense rainfalls that we're seeing over the last few decades. And climate scientists are certainly pointing to climate change on that. We're certainly seeing that in the numbers as well. The other thing is it's difficult to maintain these systems. And so, over time, the pipes that we put in the ground 50 years ago were designed under a different set of criteria. And so when rainfall changes and when climate changes, the system doesn't provide the same level of service that it used to.
I know the U of M, University of Michigan, has been working with some cities. Your firm, I assume, works with some cities about adapting to this changing weather, this changing climate. Are cities listening?
They are. However, it comes down to cost. So if you tell a community that their combined sewer system or their sewer system is undersized, and you give them the cost to do it, and it paralyzes them because they can't possibly pay for that. Cities like Ann Arbor can adapt because they have revenue.
You can't pay for flooding all the time either. I mean, that causes a lot of havoc and cost and complications for a city.
A lot of the flood mapping that FEMA did over the last few decades, they generate all these floodplain maps. Yeah, those maps are out of date. And so communities, I've seen in a lot of cases, they don't want to necessarily know or put out there the bad news that the floodplain's worse, because number one, it requires more people to have to pay for flood insurance. And they realize the cost of fixing it. It's so overwhelming that in a lot of cases it's hard to go there.
Well, let's stop talking about concrete pipes and things like that and talk about what some communities are doing. They're looking at these green stormwater management systems. How does that work?
There are some Chinese cities that put it the right way. They call them sponge cities, and that is you build low-lying areas that are designed to soak up the rainfall when it rains. So instead of going into the sewer system, the water gets soaked into the ground, and the plants take up that water and allows it to infiltrate. That we call it green stormwater infrastructure. There are lots of other fancy terms for it, but in a way, it's like putting a bunch of sponges around the city.
Does it work?
It does work.
Is it cheaper than putting new concrete pipes in?
It can reduce the cost because it reduces the volume of stormwater that gets into the system. It can help. It won't solve flooding by itself. You still have to deal with the what we call the gray infrastructure. That will never go away. And if it falls apart, you still have to replace it. But the green infrastructure can certainly help, especially in combined sewer areas, because then that's water you don't have to pay to treat.
Hmm. Other than repeated flooding, how does a community figure out that it needs to work on its stormwater management?
Usually flooding is the trigger. Sometimes regulatory action is the trigger. So if you have problems with pollution or sewer overflows, the MDEQ, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, which is the regulatory arm of the EPA, they'll come in and they'll basically tell the community that you need to do something about it. But it's usually flooding that's the big trigger because that's what gets the politicians noticing the problem.
Well, as a consultant, since it's going to cost so much to make these changes, what do you recommend cities start considering now, immediately?
Number one, to do an asset management plan. That is to take stock of all of your assets and evaluate them. Look at how do they look structurally. And once you've done that, then set up a funding source to make it happen. And so stormwater utilities are important. We've been trying to get legislation in Lansing to basically enabling legislation to allow communities to start stormwater utilities. As you're aware, there are a lot of lawsuits floating around that concept. And so without that legislation, I think a lot of communities are going to be they're probably going to avoid putting themselves out there by making or creating a stormwater utility. And that's the fee that we were talking about before.
And that's not going to make your voters very happy when they're suddenly, I'm paying for the rainfall. This is my fault. How? And I think people don't get the complications that it causes. But at the same time, when you go from a few dollars a month to hundreds of dollars a month, as has happened in Detroit in some cases, that's a lot of sticker shock to have to absorb.
It is. And I think people need to understand how we got here. If you look at the last, let's say, 35 years, going back to the early 80s, the population in Michigan has gone up about 8%. But the urbanized area in Michigan has gone up 50%. So we're all paying for more infrastructure. So even putting aside the structural condition of our infrastructure, we're all having to pay for more lane miles of roads, more water mains, more sewers. And so that is a reality. And I think as we move on, people are realizing that they have to pay higher sewer and utility bills because of that reality. And that's what people need to understand.
Greg Kozvinski is a partner and practice leader for stormwater management for OHM Advisors. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
As you heard in that interview, I kind of laughed at the distinction between a fee and a tax. Well, it turns out that's a pretty important argument that's before the courts. The Michigan Supreme Court was briefed this week on a case that would decide whether the so-called rain tax in Detroit is a user fee or a tax that would be subject to a vote of the people. The Detroit Water and Sewerage Department charges homeowners and businesses for every square foot of their property that's covered by a roof, a driveway, or an impervious surface of some kind. The idea is if the ground can't soak it up, then it's running into the sewers and all that has to be treated at the sewer treatment plant. This new fee has a lot of people hopping mad. Here's a Detroit water activist and resident, D'Amico Williams, at a public hearing last summer just before the fee was fully implemented.
We have an affordability problem in this city that you still refuse to deal with. How are we going to pay these drainage fees and you can't even conclude or calculate how much you can't charge the rain? You can't charge Mother Nature.
Lisa Walensky is an attorney representing Detroiters. She argues that the fee is actually an unlawful tax, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Just fine. So the Court of Appeals ruled the Detroit drainage charge is a lawful user fee instead of an unlawful tax. Why do you think the court got it wrong?
Well, there's several parts of the court's decision that we disagree with. One is that there was really no lack of connection between the items that are charged and the actual problem the user fee is alleged to designed to regulate. The other issue is that the Court of Appeals determined that the case was mandatory, or that the fee was mandatory, which we have some precedents in the Michigan Supreme Court regarding that in the case of Bolt versus Lansing. And that case sets out that there's three factors that the court has to look at in determining whether a user fee is a fee or whether it's a tax. And in our case, the court found in favor of the City of Detroit residents in finding that it is a mandatory fee, which under the Bolt standards would mean that the issue here is really a tax.
So let's break that down a little bit. If I own a piece of property and I've got so many square feet of roof and so many square feet of driveway, even if I take my driveway and turn it into an impervious surface so that it drains into the ground and I capture my roof water and use it in rain barrels or somehow water my garden with it, I'm not getting any credit for that now?
You're going to get a credit for it, but you can never be absolved of actually having to pay the tax. So even though you've taken efforts to show that there's no rainwater that's actually hitting the Detroit Sewage Department lines, you're still going to have to pay the fee. And because there's this compulsory nature to it, we say it's a tax is one of the reasons at least.
Okay. So if I've still got some rain that escapes from my property, it does go into the storm sewer. It does get treated. That does cost money as part of the public. Shouldn't we be paying some of that?
No, this is an issue there's no pollutants necessarily directly in the rainwater that have to be treated. The problem is that when the rainwater flows, it does pick up some particulate and other matter. But that flowing is usually occurring on a public highway, public roadway, for most of our residents at least, or even for parking lots. But those public roadways aren't even being charged.
The city argues that the roads shouldn't be taxed because they're actually part of the infrastructure that takes rainwater to the rain gutters and gets it out.
Right. We just disagree with that.
So the city of Detroit is trying to maintain a sewer system that was built for 2 million people with fees from fewer than 700,000 people. How else is the city to maintain the system if not additional billing like for treating stormwater?
Well, stormwater is not a new problem. It's been around, you know, there's been stormwater utilities that have been created since like 1972. And there's more than 1,000 across the country. So a lot of cities create a stormwater utility, and that stormwater utility can then be designed to assess fees like these. But here we have a non-metered, no utility assessing a user fee, and there's really no correlation between the user fee and the treatment that the City of Detroit is providing.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Aside from the case you're working on right now, infrastructure, sewer pipes, they're crumbling all over the place in this state. How do you think municipalities should fix the funds to fix the sewer pipes and treatment plants?
Well, I think if you're searching for something that is going to be a fee that's imposed upon everybody and it's for the purpose of collecting a revenue, then that's usually a tax. So you have to take it to the electorate to actually get their consent.
Do you see any way of calculating differently that would allow there to be a fee charged per property rather than the way it's being done right now in Detroit?
Yeah, I think they could take away some of the compulsory natures of the fee. I think that if they made it a plan where if you could show, I mean, our main client, Nicola Binns, she has a garden and a rain garden even, and she collects almost all the water on her land because she's a gardener. She should be able to apply for a 100% tax credit or user fee credit under the program. But as it is now, she automatically always has to pay that fee, even though she's not being provided the benefit of any service because she's using all her water. It's all staying on her land. So I think that would take away from the compulsory nature. And right now, the City of Detroit, any unpaid drainage fees right now are being added on to people's taxes because they're unpaid water bills. So that even adds more to the compulsory nature. I think if that part was taken out of the equation, where the drainage fee, if it wasn't paid, you didn't risk losing your house or shutting off the basic necessity of water service, I think that would make the fee, you know, much more manageable. The city has, to their credit, changed the fee since we filed the lawsuit and made it more reasonable. And so the program's becoming a little more fair, but it's still, in our opinion, with the mandatory provisions in place with residents who don't really get any service out of it being still charged, you know, we still argue that it's a tax.
Lisa Walensky is a public interest attorney and founder of ReDetroit East Community Law Center. Thanks very much for explaining this to us.
Thank you for having me.
We reached out to the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department for comment, and they sent us this statement. Quote, "We were pleased with the Court of Appeals ruling on the drainage charge and await the Michigan Supreme Court's opinion in this case." End of quote. Still to come, Governor Whitmer has a plan to restructure the Department of Environmental Quality, but Republicans don't like the changes.
This is really about her almost rewriting the mission statement of this new agency.
Plus, later in the hour, our political commentators talk about what they expect from the governor's State of the State address next week. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Democratic governor and the Republican-led legislature are butting heads about the Department of Environmental Quality, the DEQ. Like her predecessors, Gretchen Whitmer wants to restructure the DEQ in order to tackle her priorities such as clean water and climate change. Republicans are angry about the changes because it would eliminate some DEQ rules and permit review boards the last legislature and Governor Snyder put in place. Joining us now is Zach Gorchow, editor of Gongwer News Service, and Jim Malowitz, who reports on environmental issues for Bridge Magazine. So tell me about this. Governors Engler, Granholm, and Snyder, they've all made departmental changes. Why is this different?
Well, I think there's a couple factors. One is it involves some boards that were put into law just really 6-7 months ago, so it's still pretty fresh. Number two, you know, unlike most of those governors, with the exception of Granholm early on, Gretchen Whitmer's facing a unified legislature of the opposite party. So John Engler never had to worry about an executive order really getting overturned because he always had the Republican Senate to back him up. Rick Snyder had the whole legislature on his side. And at least for her second term, Jennifer Granholm had at least the House with her, too.
So why is Governor Whitmer doing this?
Well, this is Jim. Well, she's done this because she's saying that the current setup at the DEQ is not responsive enough to the public, and she wants to change the priorities. In the past, the DEQ had in its mission statement, you know, beyond protecting the environment and the state's natural resources, also protecting the economy to some extent. And this is really about her almost rewriting the mission statement of this new agency. And also she's saying that this new agency, which would also combine energy regulators as well, the Agency for Energy's duties, would also help the state tackle climate, that it would be more streamlined here and also add an element look out for environmental justice as well. So she's really trying to change the mission of the agency, and she's saying that she's trying to make it more responsive to the public.
So what are the Republicans most angry about here?
This is Zach. They are upset at the abolition in particular of something called the Environmental Permit Review Committee and the Environmental Rules Review Committee. These were committees that the Republican-led legislature passed and Governor Snyder signed to really almost take over in a lot of ways the regulatory function of the DEQ as far as issuing new regulations. No longer can the DEQ simply issue proposed regulations and essentially have total control of that process. Instead, these proposed regulations would have to go through this committee, which, according to my math, could slow the rulemaking process down by 2 years. Now, eventually, the rules could still be implemented if the governor decided to do it, but it really could slow it down and puts a number of people in the regulated industries on the committee to oversee them.
Who's on these review panels?
In the statute, it lists the panelists have to come from a certain specific industries and also a couple representing the general public. So there's a couple slots representing the general public. It's whoever the governor appoints there. Also a local health official, conservation group, environmental group. But then there's also a bunch of slots representing various industries, whether it's a waste management to oil and gas and manufacturing and the Farm Bureau. So there's this argument from some of the Democrats and environmentalists that it's basically stacked to favor industry.
Yeah, just in that list you made, I'm doing the numbers. It sounds industry heavy.
It is, and so there's some nuanced arguments going on there where Democrats are saying it's industry heavy and they could shape the rules, whereas Republicans are trying to argue that maybe no two industries always will agree. So there's a few different arguments there, and they're saying there's no real majority on the board.
And Lester Zak again, the reason the Republicans are so upset is they have been upset with the DEQ for really decades, even under Governor Snyder, feeling like it was tilted against their allies in business and industry, and these committees were a way to try to regain some type or at least level the playing field in their view. Of course, you know, as Jim was saying, environmentalists and others say that you are in effect giving those the DEQ regulates authority over the regulations.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because let's just take water, for example, because that's one of the things the governor is kind of saying we need to more concentrate on this issue. We're seeing a growing issue of water contamination. We've seen recently the advent of PFAS chemicals popping up in places we had no idea it was. We've had PCBs, dioxin, mercury, pesticides, agricultural fertilizers. If the DEQ is being so overzealous, as some Republicans are saying, why are we finding these pollutants in our fish and in our rivers and in our drinking water?
Well, that's a really good question, and that just sort of gets to the heart of the debate, and it comes as Republicans have made several moves just last session during the lame duck to try to slow down to some extent DEQ rulemaking on toxic chemical cleanups and so forth. And so there's really just a differing of opinion, I guess, on what it means to be a harsh regulator, and a lot of times too the Republicans who have pushed these panels and are supporting them now have talked about private property rights. You hear a lot of rhetoric about what the DEQ is doing in the Upper Peninsula, for instance, in keeping a lowly property owner from building on his property in a wetland.
So, right. That's what former Senator Tom Casperson argued a lot. Yeah.
Right. And so there's a wide variety of activities you could point to in these debates, a lot that the DEQ regulates. So it's kind of hard to say one way or the other, but it's also a question of values.
I guess the bottom line question here is this the end of any pretense of bipartisanship between the governor's office and the legislature?
Well, it certainly suggests that could be the case, Lester. This is Zak again. The big question is what happens now? So the Michigan House of Representatives rejected the executive order. So now it's in the hands of the Michigan Senate. If the Michigan Senate also rejects it, then the executive order is toast and it's sort of back to the drawing board for the governor. But, there's now an opportunity to maybe try to devise some type of middle ground here. Now, the governor's made it very clear she's not going to withdraw the executive order. She's not going to back down. I think the way those panels were written, like I said, I mean, for the business lobby, tends to argue for government efficiency, but, it is a process that takes 2 years to play out, efficient. Is there a way that they can agree on revising these panels? That could be one path forward. But, the governor's also made it clear that she's prepared to try to go around the legislature and ask, and has asked the attorney general to issue an opinion on whether these panels violate federal environmental law. So she made it pretty clear the other day she's going to do what it takes to get this through. That said, there's still an opportunity for both sides to sort of step back and try to find a middle ground. So I'm not prepared to say that it's all over. We've reverted to typical partisan norms, but it is trending in that direction.
Zach Gorchel is editor of Gongwer News Service. Jim Alowitz covers the environment for Bridge Magazine. Hey, good to talk to you guys.
Thanks so much.
Next week, on Tuesday, Governor Gretchen Whitmer gives her first State of the State address. Joining us to chat about what they're hoping to hear are our Friday political commentators, Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state legislator. So the governor made campaign promises, of course, road funding, pension tax repeal and stuff, but she faces some tough budget issues that threaten them. What do you want to hear or think we should hear from Whitmer, Ken?
I think one of the things she needs to kind of outline is how things are going to be different than the recent past. I mean, her election, among others, represented a big change politically in the state. And, you know, specifically, I think she's got to talk about how she can reconcile some of the campaign promises that involve money. But I think fundamentally she has to talk about how things are going to be different.
Vicki, what do you want to hear or think we should hear?
I think we're going to hear a lot about the environment, about clean drinking water. A lot of the things that she's done in her executive orders will be reflected, I believe, in her state of the state address. And I don't think there's going to be a lot of talk about money because money is going to be a problem. They're going to have to get creative and figure out how to adjust the budget that is fairly flat and may be decreasing with a recession in the next 2 years. But I think that she's going to show a shift in tone toward climate change, cleaning up our Great Lakes and our communities, and really talking about Michigan being pure Michigan again.
What about the roads? What about the pension tax repeal?
I don't think we're going to hear a lot about the pension tax repeal per se. We'll hear a lot about the roads and adjusting funding to make sure that we can start to fix the roads. And I think she's going to cover some of that. But behind the scenes, they're going to have to get creative to figure out how they're going to pay for some of these things. And she's going to be in a divided government situation, and she's going to have to learn to live with Republican policies. And she's undergoing quite a awakening right now with a rejection in the state house of one of her executive orders.
Ken, how important are these state of the state addresses as far as setting a tone for a governorship? I mean, we, the public, watch them looking for clues about what our government is going to do. But what does it mean to the legislature?
Well, there's really two different audiences. There's sort of the general public, Michigan citizens, and then there's the political class, legislators, the media, people like us. I think because it's her first one, it's important, the tone, and I think she's got to start talking about how her agenda all fits together, the fix the roads, fix the underground pipes that deliver drinking water, repeal the pension tax, shore up the school aid fund by ending diversions, universal preschool. All of these take money, and, you know, her budget message comes out later, but she's got to begin talking about how it all fits together.
Vicki, how important are these state of the state addresses for everyone?
I think they're important because they set a tone for how the public reacts to the leadership in Lansing. And Ken is right. This is her first state of the state. She's got to come out and talk about all of our hopes and dreams and be inspirational, as well as talk about following through on her campaign promises. And I think we're going to hear a lot about what Ken just mentioned, environment, infrastructure, roads. Not so much the pension tax. I don't think that's going to be a huge focus, but education and stopping the diversion. I think she's going to talk about creating a more opportunity for Michigan residents in the state of Michigan and a clean environment.
All right. So here's the big question. Are you guys going to actually watch the speech, or are you just going to read the news reports the next day?
I'm going to watch it. I always do. I love the pomp and circumstance and the history that surrounds it, as well as seeing everybody in the audience. And I find them just an exceptional experience.
Ken?
I'm going to watch it. I normally don't. I normally just listen to Michigan radio to get truth. But
thanks for the plug.
It is her first one. You know, I think it is significant, so I intend to watch it.
That is Ken Sikkema. He's a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we're here for another cocktail for Cheers. This is interesting. Got some nice ingredients here. We visited the Valentine Distillery. You've got their White Blossom Vodka, and you've got some mead. What do you call this drink?
This is the Bees and Blossoms.
Oh, that kind of sounds like spring, which I'm really hoping can arrive soon.
It does sound like spring, and this is kind of a springy drink, and then it's a little bit lighter. But for me, this is actually a winter drink because the other ingredient is blood orange juice. One of the few things that I appreciate about winter is that we get this great influx of really interesting citrus fruit. So the rest of the year, you can get lemons and limes, grapefruits, oranges, the basics. But this time of year, you get all sorts of interesting stuff. And one of those is blood oranges, which we're going to use in this cocktail today.
Okay, well, why don't you tell me how you made it?
I started off with 1.5 ounces of the White Blossom Vodka, which you mentioned earlier comes from Valentine Distilling Company and is an elderflower-flavored vodka. Elderflower has become a really popular flavor with the influx of Saint Germain, but this sort of takes that flavor and puts it into a spirit. So 1.5 ounces of that, and then 1 ounce of the blood orange juice, and then I wanted to give it some brightness, so 1/2 ounce of lemon juice. Once you put lemon juice in, you have to counter that brightness, so I went with 1/2 ounce of simple syrup. A couple dashes of Peychaud's bitters, which I kind of think of as insurance anytime you make a blood orange drink, because sometimes blood oranges aren't red at all. And when you're looking for that color, the Peychaud's bitters are bright pink, and so they're going to give you that insurance, and they're going to add some nice flavor and complexity to the drink. So I shook that up in my cocktail shaker, and then put it into a champagne flute and added 2 ounces of the standard mead from Bloom Meadworks in Ann Arbor.
Well, I think that means it's time for me to taste this, so I'm going to do that. I taste grapefruit. Why?
A lot of people, when they taste that combination of elderflower with a citrus like lemon, will detect some grapefruit. You'll also find this if you do citrus and Campari or one of those bitter aperitivos. Often you'll detect that as grapefruit as well, even if there's no grapefruit in it. And I think our minds just are geared to combine sour and those flavors and think grapefruit.
It's very, very tasty. And this reminds me of spring.
I agree. It definitely feels like spring, but this is something that is of the moment. Blood oranges come and go. By spring, they will be gone. So your moment to drink this is now.
That sounds like an invitation.
Cheers.
Look, before we wrap up the show today, we want to turn it over to John Dingell one last time. 10 years ago to the day on Michigan Radio, the congressman shared his proudest accomplishments while serving in the House. Here's what he said.
Well, there's a number of things. Getting Medicare passed. The Civil Rights Bill of 1957 and 1964, the last of which almost cost me my job. A lot of conservation legislation, the constituent service we give, a refuge for fish and wildlife that we're building on the Detroit River, better than 5,000 acres, and the national park to preserve the ground on which the Battle of the River Raisin was fought and to memorialize what was the largest casualty list in the War of 1812, which took place in Michigan on the Raisin River in Monroe.
That is John Dingell. And that's our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.